here is a special announcement. Today is Tuesday, and not, as is announced in today's Sunday Telegraph, Friday. And now, a repeat of last Thursday's performance of Monday Night is Music Night.
Well, here we are at the start of Evening Under Lamplight, the time when we usually just thank the Kip of the Cat team and move on to introduce our show, but this evening's different from all other evenings. We don't just thank Greg and Tony, but we say farewell to them. As you may have heard, our schedule is shifting around a little, and I'll no longer be following Greg into the studio on Tuesday nights. No more schmoozing about the music he's playing or enjoying the always welcoming greetings I get. Kipper the Cat is moving over to a one-hour format on Monday evenings at 11 o'clock, and Evening Under Lamplight will move, starting on August 2nd, that's just next week, to Wednesday evenings at 10 o'clock, following after Tim Willett and the New Music Generator. Will be replaced on this Tuesday evening slot by two new and very fine shows, Neil Jones' Rock Show at 9 o'clock, followed here at 11 o'clock by Gary Blue and his Blues Show. These are two knowledgeable and engaging presenters, and though I'll miss this Tuesday evening's time slot, I know it will be filled with some fine replacements. But what I'll really miss, though, is the good fellowship of Greg, Tony and Darren. But we're all still part of the Cambridge 105 community, our community radio in your city, and that's a bond that lasts. And so, to get down to business, this is Robert Louis Abrahamson inviting you to attend to this evening's Evening Under Lamplight. And since we're changing our time slot, it's a good time to bring our Dante journey to a close. There are three more cantos in the Inferno to go, and I'm going to try to fit them all into this evening's show, and that will close out Series 4 of Evening Under Lamplight. Next time, Wednesday the 2nd of August, we'll start Series 5. But let's get going. There's so much to cover here. Last time, you will recall, Dante and Virgil were lifted down from the area of Fraud Simple to the final circle of Fraud Complex, with a ride on the open palm of the giant Antaeus, another in the long line of frightening incidents Dante undergoes. And that's where we find ourselves at the start of Canto 32, in the final region of the Inferno called Cocytus. Now what? Well, there's Dante looking up in amazed wonder at this giant whose enormous hand has just deposited him there, and far, far above, there's the ledge he's just descended from. Absorbed in this wonder, Dante is suddenly recalled to himself by a voice crying out, "Guarda come passi! Hey, watch out where you're stepping, man. Don't go stepping on our heads, the heads of me and my miserable, worn-down brothers." As though there's any brotherhood at this level. Who's speaking? Only now, Dante turns around and looks at what lies before him, a lake, so frozen that it seems to be made of glass, not water. This is significant on a metaphorical or symbolical level. First of all, this ice is the physical equivalent of hatred, that frozen, inert state in which we refuse to reach out to another but stay immobile within ourselves. Or if we do reach out, it's not to embrace, but to hurt. Let's go to Dorothy Sayers again for her sharp and eerie explanation of this region. Beneath the clamor, beneath the monotonous circlings, beneath the fires of hell, here at the center of the lost soul and lost city, lie the silence and the rigidity and the eternal frozen cold. It is perhaps the greatest image in the whole inferno. A cold and cruel egotism, gradually striking inward, till even the lingering passions of hatred and destruction are frozen into immobility. That is the final state of sin. Or we might say, this ice represents the externalization of the inner state of psychic numbness. But there's more to the image of ice. Water, we know, is the essential regenerative element. But here, at the bottom of hell, it is frozen, unable to sustain life. And Dante adds that it's more like glass than water. That is, it's like a looking glass, a mirror. All you get down here is a reflection of yourself. This is the epitome of community destroying sin. One sees the world only in terms of oneself. from the freaky psychedelic Motown period, Diana Ross and the Supremes, Reflections, sort of breaking the mood I've been trying to establish, but the song is sort of relevant, sort of. Well, in Poking Out of the Ice are the heads of the denizens of this region, pale with cold, teeth chattering, their faces turned down, their eyes streaming with tears of pain and misery. Sin, or self-centered egotism, always leaves us miserable, never happy or content, whether the sinner realizes this or not. Here in hell, the misery is externalized as these tears. Dante looks around for a few minutes in amazement and notices two shades placed face to face, so close that their hair merges into one mat. Here is physical proximity, but spiritual alienation. Dante asks them who they are. Yet another question in this long poem filled with questions. And they try to look up to see who's addressing them. As they strain their necks to look up, the tears that had been able to flow when their heads were facing down now spill down to their lips, where they turn to ice, thus freezing together the lips of these two faces in a kind of parody of a loving kiss. They can't speak to answer the question, since their mouths are glued together with frozen ice, and their hatred of each other finds outlet in the only part of them they can move, their foreheads, and they start butting each other, come due becchi, like two rams. Who are they? Another voice, presumably the one who told Dante to watch out, coming from the head that had lost both ears, frozen and then broken off. This voice identifies the two headbutters. They are Alessandro and Napoleone degli Alberti, two brothers who killed each other over a quarrel about their inheritance. We don't know much more about them, and we're told that this first part of Cocytus is called Caina, named after Cain, who slew his brother Abel. Here's the region where brother betrays brother, or more widely, where there is treachery against any family member. There, for instance, is Mordred, who rose up against his father, King Arthur, and others whom this voice from the ice points out. Okay, that's enough. Dante and Virgil walk on. Dante shivering in the cold, and then he's not sure how, maybe on purpose, but maybe by chance, his foot strikes out and smacks one of these heads right in the face. Hey, who do you think you are to go around kicking people in the face? Dante turns to Virgil. Virgil, do you mind if I stop for a minute to ask this face some questions? After that, I'll move along as fast as you want. That's fine with Virgil. So Dante asks, who are you? But this soul is truculent and won't answer except to mirror Dante's words, who are you? Look, says Dante, trying to bribe him to speak. Look, I'm alive, and if you want some fame, I can tell the world about you when I get back up above. Sure, that's the last thing I want, says the head. Get out of here and stop bothering me. You don't even know that down here no one wants people in the upper world to know anything about them. Dante doesn't take this peacefully. He reaches down and grabs the man by the scruff of the neck. Listen, man, either you tell me who you are, or I'll leave not one single hair on your head. Yeah? Well, you can peel me bald, and I won't tell you who I am, not give a hint, even if you jump upon my head 1,000 times. So what do you do now? Well, Dante carries out his threat and starts pulling out hair while the head starts howling. And then suddenly another voice calls out and identifies this figure as Bocca degli Abati. Oh, so that's who you are, Dante says, and then in spite, Bocca starts naming all the others around him. But who is Bocca, and what did he do? I haven't gone into much of the politics in the Inferno, and won't do so now, but it's important to know that Bocca degli Abati was fighting on the side of the Florentine Guelphs at the Battle of Montaperti. But then he cut off the hand of the Guelph standard-bearer so that the flag fell and the Florentines thought they were ruined and fled in panic. In other words, he was a traitor to his own side right in the middle of a battle. And that lets us know that we've moved on to another section of Cocytus, Antenora, the region for those who betrayed their country or their party, named after Antenor, a Trojan who, in the Middle Ages anyway, was believed to have betrayed Troy into the hands of the Greeks. And there are several others named, whom I won't spend time with. Like Dante and Virgil, we too are in something of a rush. And like them, we move on and we come to probably the most gruesome moment in the Inferno. Are you ready? There in the ice before him, Dante sees two souls frozen into the same hole, the one head facing the back of the other head. But that's not all. The head in the back is eating the brains of the one in front, just at the place where the brain stem meets the spinal cord. You can imagine that Dante wants to know more about this. "Tell me why you're doing this," he says to the one in back. "And maybe once I know, I can redeem your reputation back in the living world." And with that, Canto 32 ends. A cliffhanger. Don't worry, that was the right speed. It was an example of the famous bass singing, music from a Russian cathedral, a reading or chanting or something from Paul's letter to the Romans. There's nothing like this, is there? And weren't we having fun as undergraduates, hooking up our record player so it blared out this track across the campus at 3 o'clock in the morning? But now on to Canto 33, the dreadful story of Ugolino della Gherardesca. In this canto, words for weeping and grief appear 13 different times. Let's spend a minute getting some background. The head behind, the one eating the other's brains, belongs to Ugolino della Gherardesca, who, I don't need to go into detail, but he changed sides in that constant factionalism in Tuscany, betraying one side to the other. Thus, Ugolino is frozen in the region of Antenora for traitors to country or party. But the other head, belonging to Archbishop Ruggieri degli Ubaldini, is across the boundary line, an invisible line. Boundaries are no longer marked out here. Across the boundary in the next region, Ptolemaea, named after Ptolemy, a captain of Jericho, who invited Simon the high priest and his sons to a banquet and slew them there. So this is the region for those who betrayed hospitality. And although Archbishop Ruggieri was just as conniving in the political arena as all the others, he committed a worse sin towards Ugolino and his sons, imprisoning them in a tower and then starving them to death. Everyone knew that Ugolino died in captivity, but now we hear the inside story. Or at least the inside story Dante the poet creates for us to illustrate the depths of evil. Dante had asked Ugolino to explain why he bears such hatred for the other soul, and here's the reply. Motivated, not by any desire for truth or for self-justification even, but only so he can ruin any reputation Ruggieri might still have on Earth. Ugolino stops gnawing at Ruggieri's head, then wipes his bloody mouth in Ruggieri's hair and tells his story. He was imprisoned in a tower, now known as the Hunger Tower, for several months, until one night he had a horrible dream about a hunter with his hounds tracking down a wolf and its cubs, and they caught their prey and ripped the flesh off their backs. And then he woke up and heard his children. Oh yeah, his sons were there with him. He forgot to mention them earlier. He heard his children weeping in their sleep and asking for bread. They'd had similar dreams. It was the hour when they usually had their food brought to them. But instead of hearing the door of the tower opening, they heard, still troubled by their dreams, they heard people down below nailing up the door. At this sound, and the understanding that they were being barricaded in with no food, Ugolino looks at his children, senza far moto, without saying a word. Io non piangea, si dentro impetrai, he says. I did not weep. Inward, I turned to stone. Dante wants us at this point to remember the parable Jesus tells with the catch line, if a son shall ask for bread of any of you that is a father, will he give him a stone? But that's what Ugolino does give, a stone. That's all. And turning to stone is the pivotal moment, perhaps the moment when Ugolino is definitively damned, and the ice gets ready to receive his soul, placing him in that mirror where all he sees is himself. He does not weep. He does not speak to his sons, not to comfort them or do anything to ease their pain and fright. What are you staring at? His little Anselm asks. Father, what's wrong? Well, what's wrong is that he's just lost his soul. And he says nothing all that day and all the next night. When day dawns again, he looks and sees his four sons' faces with the same expression as his own. Here's the mirror again. The sons are just reflections of himself. Ugolino, in grief, starts gnawing his hands, and the boys, assuming he's just hungry, offer themselves to him as food. You're the one who gave us this flesh. Now it's only right that you should rip it off. Well, well, at least he thinks of them now. To ease their grief, he calms down. But he does not reach out to them, and for two more days he doesn't say a word. On the fourth day, little Gaddo falls down at his father's feet. Padre mio, che non m'aiuti? Why don't you help me, Dad? Is how Robin Kirkpatrick translates this. And then Gaddo dies. And then on the next day and the day after, he sits there watching the other three die. And I began, he tells Dante, I began, already blind, to grope over their bodies, and for 2 days called to them though they were dead. Then hunger proved a greater power than grief. And at that, Ugolino stops talking and grabs Ruggieri's skull again like a dog clamping its teeth on a bone. What happened? Hunger proved a greater power than grief. What did he do? Did he just die of hunger? Or did he, could he, would he, would he now turn and eat his son's bodies? We just don't know. And actually, we don't need to know. This is a horrible story, as I'm sure you'll agree. And Ugolino milks it as best he can. In reality, the four others in the tower with him were not his little boys, but two of his sons, probably in their 30s or 40s, and two of his grandsons. A pathetic story, but not quite as pathetic as the death of four little sons. But the real feature of this story is not its pathos, but the way Ugolino, or Dante, gives us clues about the damnation. We've seen the echo of Jesus' parable. But other hints point to the boys as images of Christ. "Eat us," they say, turning themselves into some kind of redeeming Eucharist. And when Gado dies, he asks why his father does not help him, echoing Jesus on the cross, asking, my God, why hast thou forsaken me?" There are other details that bring out this identification further, but I leave that for you someday to play around with. Someday, when you get around to reading the Inferno for yourself in an edition with good notes. And remember back to this year when you heard all about Dante's Inferno from your friendly voice on Evening Under Lamplight, telling you all about the horrors of stone-souled Ugolino. That was part of a piece called In the Stone Room by a group called Einoma. I know very little more about it, but it seemed to fit here. And here is where we are, sharing Evening Under Lamplight, you and me, Robert Louis Abrahamson, on Cambridge 105.
When the day comes to an end, he invites you to attend Evening Under Lamplight. It's Cambridge 105. Community radio in your city.
After hearing the end of Ugolino's story, Dante the poet turns to curse the city of Pisa for having allowed such injustice to be done. Even if Ugolino himself had been a traitor, they should never have tortured and killed the sons as well. But enough. Time to move on, further into Ptolemaea, the region of treachery to one's guests. The souls in this region, we now learn, have their faces upwards, which means that their tears freeze in their eyeballs, thus blocking further tears from flowing, adding suppressed grief to the underlying grief they already suffer from. But whew, is it cold here? And there's a strong wind stirring here, reinforcing the cold. But wait, how could there be wind here? Dante knows that winds arise because the sun heats one area more than another, causing air in the warm place to rise and air from the cooler place to rush in to fill the vacuum. But there's no sunlight here to heat up some places. What produces the wind? He asks Virgil, but Virgil, once again, tells Dante just to wait. He'll soon discover what generates this wind. Then another voice pipes up. Boy, you two must be really evil to be assigned here at the lowest level. But as you pass, look, do me a favor. Could you just knock off these chunks of ice in my eyes so I can have some relief and cry a little, even for a very short time? If you want my help, Dante says, then you have to tell me who you are. And then, if I don't do what you want, may I have to travel to the very bottom of the ice? Discovering this soul's name, Fra Alberigo, astounds Dante. But wait, I thought you were still alive. Have you just died in the past day? Oh, I have no idea what my body's doing up there. Yes, my body is still living, but you see, my soul is here in hell. This is a common situation here in Ptolemaea. A soul comes down here before the body is properly dead. The moment a person commits these really evil sins of treachery, the soul falls down here while some devil takes over the body until it's time for that body to die. So what do we have here? A zombie? Or at least a zombie up on Earth, right? A zombie is a body without a soul. And here Dante gives us insight into what the other half of the zombie is like, the soul divorced from the quasi-living body. You might be surprised to hear that the Catholic doctrine, at least in the Middle Ages, accepted this sort of thing as true. And it is true, I suppose. If someone commits a really heinous sin with careful forethought and planning and no care for the welfare of anyone else, then psychologically it may happen that this person becomes so burned by the act that he can no longer function as a real person. All he does from that point on is dictated by the consequences of that sin. In other words, everything that made the person a real human being, notably the free will to choose his actions, has malfunctioned, or in fact has ceased to function at all. Dante's myth portrays the psychological state, then, as that person's soul now frozen in hell, while the body is just moved along by some mindless demon. Oh, by the way, what was it that Alberigo did that was so sinful? Well, remember that Ptolemaea houses those who betrayed the trust of their guests, an act that breaks up all human fellowship and corrupts the trust that must underlie our essential connection to everyone else. But the people Alberigo betrayed were not only his guests, but his kin. There was a family feud over certain property rights. Alberigo invited his cousin and his cousin's son to dinner as a gesture of goodwill. Come on, have a dinner with me. But at the end of the meal, Alberigo told the servants, "Bring on the fruit course." And that was the signal for his men to rush in and murder the unsuspecting cousin guests. And then I suppose at that very moment, Alberigo's soul was expelled from the body and into the icy depths of the inferno, while the demon eased into the now vacant body, which takes the form that our modern myths call a zombie.
Well, no one told me about her, the way she lied. Well, no one told me about her, how many people cried. But it's too late to say you're sorry. How would I know? Why should I care? Please don't bother trying to find her. She's not there. The way she had said, the color of her hair. Her voice was soft and cool, her eyes were clear and bright, but she's not there. Well, no one told me about her. What could I do? Well, no one told me about. They all knew, but it's too late to say you're sorry. How would I know? Why should I care? Please don't bother trying to find her. She's not there. Well, let me tell you about the way she looked, the way she acted, the color of her hair. Her voice was soft and cool, her eyes were clear and bright, but she's not there. Should I care? Please don't bother trying to find her.
That was, of course, The Zombies with She's Not There. Can you imagine spending time with someone up in our world who you think is a living soul and discovering that she's not there? Perhaps this happens more often than we think. It's too late to say you're sorry. Well, it's too late for the zombie to say she's sorry at any rate. And Fra Alberigo? No, Dante does not take the ice out of his eyes. He's become clever, and notice he said, "May I go all the way to the bottom of hell if I don't do what you ask?" And in fact, he knows he is going to the bottom of the hell. And thus we come to the end of Canto 33, and are ready to enter the final canto of Dante's Inferno. Canto begins with the words of a famous processional hymn, Vexilla Regis Prodeunt, the royal banners forward go. It's a traditional hymn sung in the week before Easter, celebrating Jesus' entry into Jerusalem, leading up to the crucifixion, as the second line of the hymn suggests, Fulget Crucis Mysterium, the cross shows forth redemption's flow. But why should we attend to it here? Well, because this is how Dante opens the 34th and final canto of the Inferno. But he adds one more word to the first line. Vexillo regis prodeunt inferni, making these the banners of the king of hell that are going forward. And so we might be expecting some kind of infernal procession now, some kind of climax to all that has come before. But we don't get that. We find neither procession nor really climax. Take a look, Dante, Virgil says. See if you can make out that king of hell. And Dante peers ahead into the murkiness, and it seems to him he can see some sort of windmill in the distance, with its huge sails turning round and round. But meanwhile, the wind is getting stronger and colder, so Dante shields himself behind Virgil, the way you shield a fruit tree behind a protective wall. Dante looks down at the ice. There are no heads protruding here now, as there had been in previous areas of Cocytus. No, Dante looks and sees a whole assortment of figures, all entirely submerged beneath the ice, in all different positions. Some are lying down, he says, still others stand erect, some with heads, some with feet up, some bent like bows, their faces to their toes. He's now at the final region, where we find traitors to sworn allegiance. This is Judeca, named after Judas Iscariot, who betrayed his leader, Jesus. Here, Dorothy Sayers says, cut off from every contact and every means of expression, those who committed the final treason lie wholly submerged. Spend a minute feeling the eeriness of this place. It's dark. It's cold. There's a mysterious wind blowing steadily against you. And under your feet lie the randomly scattered, frozen forms of numerous bodies in grotesque positions and no doubt with repulsive expressions of horror on their faces. And there's no sound, except perhaps the whistling of the wind in your ears, a sound that makes the silence even more eerie. Then suddenly Virgil steps aside so Dante can see straight ahead of him, and Virgil calls out, "Ecco dite! Look there at this," or we might say, "Behold Satan." And there he is, the emperor of hell. "Arm yourself with fortitude," Virgil advises. Yes, because Dante has now arrived at the decisive moment leading to his healing transformation. He now sees the worst. "Io non mori e non rimasi vivo," he tells us. "I did not die and I did not stay alive." He is now in that middle nowhere state, the Einuma place, known as the dark night of the soul. "Imagine if you can," Dante says to us, "imagine what it felt like to be deprived of both death and life." And then we get a gradual description of what Dante sees before him. The emperor of the woeful kingdom rising out of that icy surface. The first thing that strikes Dante is his size. His torso rises 800 feet above the ice, and that's just the part of him from his navel up. The rest lies hidden below. Satan is the name given to the fallen angel Lucifer, who was once the fairest and greatest of all the angels until, the myth says, until he rebelled and wanted an even greater place in the kingdom of heaven and was cast out, or we might say cast himself out by his actions, and fell down here through the surface of the earth to this spot. And as beautiful as he once was, so he is hideous now, frozen in that expression of raised eyebrow in derision of his creator. After the size and the overall hideousness, Dante notices that he actually has three faces on his head, white, yellow, and black, a kind of mockery of the Trinity in heaven. Then Dante notices the wings. Angels, the prophet Isaiah says, have three pairs of wings, and Satan retains his six wings, but instead of graceful, shining plumage, his wings have degenerated into bat wings, with no feathers at all. They're more massive than any sail Dante's ever seen on a boat, but this boat is going nowhere. The wings are in constant motion. That was the windmill Dante thought he'd seen in the distance. And the wind they create is what freezes this whole area. Everything here is a kind of sterile parody of healthier, normal life. If this figure is going to be compared to a windmill, it's a kind of parody of a windmill. A windmill, as you know, receives the wind and then converts it into energy to do something useful. Or, to raise it metaphorically, since wind and spirit are in Hebrew, Greek, and Latin the same word, the windmill is an image of how we can open ourselves to the spirit moving around us and convert that into useful energy, useful activity in our world, right? But Satan's windmill does not receive any wind, any spirit. It produces wind, an evil, harmful wind, but also, like all things, a wind that ultimately works for justice, since it produces the ice that appropriately encases these worst of traitors. Next, Dante notices that out of his six eyes, yeah, you know, three faces, two eyes in each, out of his six eyes, he is weeping. They're all weeping down here, of course. And the tears drip down his three chins, where he's drooling bloody saliva. Satan is just like the other functionaries of hell, moving mechanically, repetitively, here just a drooling idiot. And why bloody saliva? Well, Dante notices next that in each of the three mouths is a body whom Satan is grinding his teeth on. The two side figures are feet first in the mouth, but the central figure is head first in the devil's mouth, his feet sticking out and kicking while Satan's claws rip the flesh off the figure's back. Who are these three? The central one, as befits this Christian myth, is Judas. The other two, modern readers are surprised to learn, are Brutus and Cassius, two Romans who turned against Julius Caesar and conspired against him, which means they betrayed, in an indirect way, the Roman Empire, which was the central political institution in Dante's view. They represent treason against the secular government of the world, while Judas represents treason against the divine government of the world. For Judas, remember, offered to betray Jesus to the authorities for 30 pieces of silver.
Then went one of the disciples, whose name was Judas Iscariot, to the chief priests and said,
"How much will ye give me if I betray him to you?"
And they bargained for 30 silver pieces. And from that time he sought opportunity that he might betray him.
And that's it. I remember some of my students feeling disappointed, affronted even, that Satan was such an anticlimax. At least he could have threatened Dante or something, but no, he has no mind left even to notice Dante or to do anything except what he's always done over and over. Why does Dante present us with such a minimal devil? The Christian myth, like all myths, allows for a variety of different presentations of its characters. Sometimes the devil is portrayed as a roaring lion, roaming around, seeking whom to devour. Sometimes the devil is seen as a tragic, fallen figure, as in Milton's version, or as some kind of suave pseudo-gentleman, deftly luring us to our ruin. But Dante is not interested so much in the act of temptation. He wants to emphasize what has happened to our soul once we give in to these self-centered, unloving acts which the Church calls sin. And so, all along the way, we have been given images of the state of the soul, the state of our soul, when it has consented to these evil acts. The ones who gave in to illicit sex being tossed around helplessly, round and round the same routine. The angry ones who can do nothing but rip themselves and others to bits. The flatterers who wallow in vile excrement and so on. You remember all these. We are on this journey to see ourselves in them, and seeing what we could become, we can see to refuse the temptation, however it comes. But now Virgil reminds Dante that it's getting late, time to move on. Che tutto avem veduto, for we have seen all. And with that, the journey to the bottom of hell finishes. I always like at this point to read out a retrospective Thomas Bergen offers us. Virgil's statement that we have now seen all is a fair assessment of the wealth of the literal narrative. The promise of the early cantos has been fulfilled. The pace has never slackened, has indeed accelerated. The story is crammed with action and variety. The poets have come through no less than 21 carefully identified areas. Dante has seen 128 sinners specifically mentioned by name, not counting the vast armies of the unnamed, and has had conversations with 37 of them. He has met 30 monsters and 5 hybrid creatures. He has had 2 boat rides. He has ridden a centaur and a winged dragon. He has twice fainted. He has been exposed to excessive heat, bitter cold, strong winds, fearful sights, terrifying sounds, and foul odors. To this catalogue of physical traits must be added a complete stock of emotional and psychological experiences. He has felt compassion, pity, scorn, resentment, anger, vindictiveness, courage, and even once in a while a touch of amusement. And all of these emotions are superimposed on the constants of terror, wonder, and lively curiosity. Nor do the pilgrim's own experiences exhaust the mind of the narrative. T.S. Eliot well says that the tale of Ulysses, regardless of its moral or symbolic interpretation, is a well-told sailor's yarn. We may add that Francesca's, by the same token, is a moving love story. Pierre Delevingne and Guido da Montefeltro recount behind-the-scenes tales of intrigue in high places. From Farinata, we get the inside story of a great decision. From Vanni Fucci, a thief's detailed confession. Caccia un amico, Bocca degli Abati, Bertram de Born, even in the compass of the few syllables allowed to them, hint at other vicissitudes of humanity in action.
Time to resign from the human race. Wipe those tears from your lovely face. Baby, wave to the mane in the old red caboose.
All right, why not a bit of Kinky Friedman before all hell breaks loose? Tutto avem veduto. We have seen it all. All the worst in the human soul, in our own soul too, let's hope. And where do we go from here? Well, the immediate problem is how do Virgil and Dante get out of that icy region? Virgil has no hesitation about what to do. Here, get on my back and put your arms around my neck. Now we wait until the wings are way back there, out of the way, and then, whoa, well, we'll just climb down this big guy's side using these clumps of shaggy fur as handholds. And so they climb down and below the surface of that ice. And then suddenly, just when they come to the thigh, Virgil suddenly, with great effort, pivots and turns around and starts climbing upwards. What? We're going back up there? Dante thinks in panic. But then there appears an opening in the rock with a ledge where Virgil puts Dante down and they both rest a minute. Dante looks up, expecting to see that enormous torso and gruesome trio head of Satan up above, but no, he looks up and sees the enormous legs rising up far above his head. What's going on? Okay, enough rest, says Virgil. Let's get moving. Wait a minute. Wait, clear something up for me, Dante says. Where's the ice? Why is this giant figure upside down all of a sudden? You might have guessed the answer, right? When Virgil climbed down to the side of Satan, he was headed towards the center of the earth. At the thigh, he came to the exact center. Popular myth, of course, holds that the people before Columbus thought the earth was flat, but that is false, and we see here that Dante knew exactly what the physics of gravity are all about. You go down as you head towards the center, and then, if you don't change your direction, you start going upwards. Right? And so that's what they're doing. And now, looking upwards at Satan, you see his feet, when on the other side of the center, you saw his torso rising up. Why all this fuss here, besides the ingenious physical details? Well, this whole journey is undertaken, you'll recall, to get Dante out of his dark woods, out of his state of error, where the right path is lost. He's had to go down through hell, through the worst in himself, before he can turn around and start rising up, up to the highest heaven, where he'll end the final part of the Divine Comedy. So it's all about turning around. We saw the preparation for this when he faced Satan and was neither dead nor alive, poised for that turn. And this moment we've just seen is the physical manifestation of his spiritual and psychological conversion, con plus version, turning around. And we all have to remember this pivotal moment. Whenever we experience a moment of conversion, whether the big lifetime conversion like Dante's or any of the small moments in everyday life, seeing our son of a bitch boss in the more understanding light, holding our tongue when about to say something cutting to the cold caller on the phone, that sort of thing. In these moments, if we're attentive, we might just spot that feeling that we are just headed back to the nastiness once again before we realize that, no, we've come through it all. And coming through it all, Dante and Virgil hear the trickling of a small stream flowing down, living water as opposed to all the dead water in hell, stinking mud, boiling blood, frozen ice. Well, they follow this stream up, and finally they see up ahead a hole in the rock through which they catch a glimpse of the sky. The journey from the dark wood to the center of the earth took 24 hours. And this ascent from the center back to the surface took another 24 hours, though Dante spends less than one line describing it. It's been a long, grueling experience, but here they are again in the fresh air. Uscimmo a rivedere le stelle. We came out to see the stars once again. And that's it now for our journey with Dante into and out of the Inferno. Thanks for attending with me over the past 30 episodes of Evening Under Lamplight here on Cambridge 105. Go back and listen again to earlier episodes at momentsunderlamplight.co.uk and come back next week, August 2nd, a Wednesday night, to join me, Robert Louis Abrahamson, for the new Series 5 of Evening Under Lamplight. I think we'll start with the theme of Wednesday, or middleness, or Mercury the trickster. See you then. And here's a little bit of the Nocturne by Mendelssohn to take us out.